Today we're going to continue, and maybe we'll be finishing up today the topics that are likely to be covered on the second exam. We'll see how far we get. I want to get as far as being able to compose linear transformations, but we may not actually reach this point. I have a fair amount to talk about. I'll start by reminding you what a linear transformation is and how they're related to matrices. Then, just as we attached a bunch of subspaces to a matrix, I'm also going to attach two different subspaces to a linear transformation. The connection between linear transformations and matrices is then going to allow me to find bases for these subspaces. Remember, subspaces are the interesting sets of vectors that occur in linear algebra, and bases are essential to linear algebra because that's what you need to provide coordinates for points that live inside a subspace. So we'll figure out a way, once I attach subspaces to a linear transformation, we'll use the connection with matrices to figure out a way of actually nailing down a basis for these two subspaces, and that will give us a way of coordinatizing the points that live in those subspaces. And simultaneously, as soon as you have a basis, intuitively, that means a set of independent directions that is capable of generating the whole subspace. Well, by counting those independent directions, you get the dimension of the subspace. And what we'll find is that the dimensions of these two subspaces is kind of a zero-sum game. The range of a linear transformation, its dimension plus dimension of this other space, they have to add up to the dimension of the domain of your linear transformation. So that's really easy to see once we've made these connections. And then finally, what may get delayed until Friday's lecture is my talking about taking two linear transformations and composing them as you would functions, so you can go from one space to another vector space. All right, so let me start by just reviewing what we covered last time. A linear transformation, these are the basic kind of functions that occur in linear algebra. They take you from one vector space to another vector space. But in addition, they have to behave well with respect to our fundamental operations. So we have a compatibility requirement for scalar multiplication, whether we do scalar multiplication before or after we apply the function t, we should get the same result. And similarly, whether we add vectors before we apply the function or after we apply the function, we should still get the same result. So these, we have a linear transformation, we're only looking at functions that have these properties. All right, and then what we saw last time is if we have a function satisfying these two properties, then one way to make it such a function is to take a matrix. And what you do is you regard matrix multiplication as giving you this application. All right, so I guess I can write on the blackboard here. So if this is going to be an n by m matrix, well, in order for this matrix multiplication to be defined, it's got to be a column vector. So number of columns in the first factor has to equal the number of rows in the second factor. But then what such a matrix multiplication is going to kick out, so that's the match you need. And then the dimension of the result in product is going to be an n by 1. So effectively, this matrix multiplication is taking you from m-dimensional vectors to n-dimensional vectors. So it is defining a function between these two vector spaces. And what happens is that the function you create using matrix multiplication to define it, it naturally satisfies these two properties. Basically, because scalar multiplication commutes with matrix multiplication, and matrix multiplication distributes over sums. All right, so that's one connection between matrices and linear transformations. We can always make a linear transformation from a matrix. But what we saw last time is we can go the opposite way as well. Given any function between Rm and Rn that satisfies these two properties, there's a matrix that exactly replicates the action of that function. So the statement is that if you have a function between two vector spaces that's actually a linear transformation, then the way it acts on a vector can be replicated by a certain matrix multiplication. And in fact, what we saw last time was that how to actually construct this matrix. What we do is we look at how T acts on some special vectors, the standard basis vectors for Rn. So for example, E1 is 1, 0, 0, and then the last standard basis vector is the vector 1, 0, 0, all zeros until we reach that last slot. So these are your natural coordinate vectors for Rn. And what we do to get this matrix is we examine how the function acts on our standard coordinate vectors, use those results, and rewrite them as the columns of the matrix. Now, every time I act on one of these vectors, they live inside Rm, and so this function is going to act on them. It's going to take them to a new vector that I'm now going to write as a column. Well, that's going to make this matrix A subscript T, the matrix attached to the given linear transformation. It's going to be a matrix with n rows, because we're writing these results vertically, and a total of m columns, as many columns as we have basis vectors for the domain. All right, and then it turns out that when we analyze linear transformations, the most direct way to get to a calculational setting is to create this numerical matrix. And in fact, that's exactly what's done. All right, so what I'm going to do next then is these matrices are going to be essential to analyzing these linear transformations. And so we start today looking at subspaces attached to a linear transformation, and then we'll find bases. But in fact, all calculations are going to flow through this particular matrix that we can always construct once we're given a linear transformation. Okay, so for matrices, we had three subspaces naturally associated with them. We could take the row vectors of the matrix and take all possible linear combinations. That will create a subspace of, I guess, Rm if we have an n by m matrix. Each row would have exactly m entries. And so the span of the row vectors is going to be some subspace of Rm. We also have a column space. This is actually sitting inside Rm. The column space, well, the columns, each column is going to have as many entries as we have rows. So those column vectors are going to be n-dimensional vectors. When I take all possible linear combinations, I get a subspace of Rn. And then we had one more subspace that we could attach to a given matrix. Rather than looking at the spans of sets of vectors, we look at the solution set of the corresponding homogeneous system. And for this multiplication to be fine, this column vector, did I erase it? I guess I did. This column vector has to live inside Rm. So that's actually a subspace of Rm. All right, so that's the, when I introduce the subspaces for matrices, these are the ones we looked at. We're going to do a corresponding analogous discussion for linear transformations, except I'm not going to introduce the subspaces attached to a linear transformation by referring to the matrix that corresponds to it. Rather, I'm going to define these in a more function-centric way. So let's start. Let's see. Well, the first subspace we'll look at is called the range of a linear transformation. Let me first define it. Its definition is based on function theory. So here I'm thinking really abstract, sort of high school function theory. You have two sets A and B, and you have a function that takes elements of A to points F of A that are sitting inside another set. Now, in function theory, There's a notion of the image of a function. And what that is, it's the subset of all points in your codomain, your target space, that can be reached by applying this function. So for example, that's called the image. So the image of f, this is going to be every point in your codomain that can be reached by applying the function. So mathematically, the condition is you're looking for points in the codomain such that b is equal to f of a for some element a that lives inside the domain. Now, if you had f that sends x to, say, x squared, the image of this function, what's it going to be? Well, this is a function from on the real line, say, taking real numbers to real numbers. And if you, x gets mapped to x squared, well, what in fact happens is you never reach the negative numbers by applying this function, right? Because the square of a real number is always non-negative. It could be zero if x itself is zero, but it's always, other than that, it's always positive. And so this map doesn't completely cover the codomain. It only gets about half of it. It only reaches the positive numbers. And so the image sets is not generally the entire codomain. It's usually a smaller set that sits inside it. But since it's a subset of a larger set, you think that there might be an analogous construction, which in linear algebra, the important subsets are subspaces. And so that's, in fact, exactly what we do to define this range. We take the functional idea, finding all points that can be reached by applying a function, and we put it in the linear algebraic setting, where now our function is mapping between two vector spaces. So what will the analog of this construction would be a subset of the domain, such that consists of points that can be reached by applying T. And so there's the definition, mimics exactly this. The range of a linear transformation are the points in the target place, the place you land after applying the function, that can be reached by applying your function to some point in the domain. All right, so that sets it up as a, that sets it up as a subset of, well, these guys are all living inside Rn. All right, now that's a subset, it's not necessarily a subspace. So what I want to show you next is that, in fact, this subset of Rn is closed under scalar multiplication, closed under vector addition, and so is a subspace. Subspaces, as in most things in linear algebra, what we really require is a nice behavior with respect to scalar multiplication and vector addition. And so that's what we'll use here. So suppose we have a linear transformation between two vector spaces. My claim is that the range of T is a subspace. And so what I'm going to have to show is that if I start off with any number lambda and a point that lives inside that subset, after I do scalar multiplication, I'm still inside that subset. Or if I start off with two vectors living inside the subset and I add them together, I'm still inside the subset. This is closure under scalar multiplication. This is closure under vector addition. All right, so let's see this. These are both easy to see. Suppose I'm going to show you closure under scalar multiplication first. So let's choose any point inside the range and choose any number lambda. What I'm going to show you is that the scalar multiplication of this guy by lambda is still inside that subset. All right, so if y is in the range, well, then it had to come from some point. Well, I can just change this picture a little bit. R m t and r m. So, and maybe call this x t of x. And if we start off with some point in this range, it had to come from some x over here. Well, that's what I'm saying here. Anything that lives in the range had to come from the domain by the applications of function t. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to multiply this equation, which basically corresponds to this fact, I'll multiply it by lambda. So here it is. Multiply both sides, but the thing is that t is a linear transformation. So this scalar multiplication after I apply the function t to x is equivalent to, this has the same value as t applied to the scalar multiplication of x by lambda. But now I see that this point lambda y lies in the range because it's the image of this particular point after applying t. And transition between these two lines is true because linear transformation is a has a special property that it's invariant under scalar, it's preserved scalar multiplication. And so the fact that lambda y is always in the image of t means that, well, it's closed under scalar multiplication. So if you have any number in every point in the range, then the scalar multiplication of that point in the range by lambda remains inside that subset. And so the range is closed under scalar multiplication. Okay, so it's a pretty simple argument. It's just restating definitions effectively. What about vector addition? Same idea. If we start off with two vectors that live inside the range, that means they had to come from some vectors x1 and x2 that lived inside the domain. Let x1 be the some vector inside the domain that produces y1 after applying t. This is guaranteed because y has to be in the range of t. Similarly for y2. What I'll do is I'll take these two equations, I'll add them, I get this, and then because t is a linear transformation, t of x1 plus t of x2 is the same thing as t applied to x1 plus x2, because linear transformations, you can delay vector addition of a sum of vectors, you can delay that until after you apply the function, that addition until after you apply the function. So that shows you that y1 plus y2, the sum of two vectors that live inside the domain, is actually the image of a particular point in the domain, the vector x1 plus x2. And then that shows you that y1 plus y2 also lives inside the range. And so we start off with two vectors in the range, their vector sum still lives inside the range of that function. And so the range of t is closed under vector addition. So to tie things together, we simply have to observe that a subspace is a subset that's closed under scalar multiplication and vector addition. Two slides ago, I showed you that it was closed under scalar multiplication. The preceding slide, I showed you that it's closed under vector addition. And so the range of T is a subspace. All right, so we've got an abstract subspace now. How can we do something concrete with it? Well, what will bring the subspace into a calculational setting is by displaying a basis for it, a way to coordinatize it. And so that's going to be pretty easy. Suppose we have a linear transformation. Well, we know how to attach a matrix to such a linear transformation. We take the standard basis vectors, we apply the function t to them, that will give us n-dimensional vectors that we can write as columns. Putting those columns together in a single matrix, we get an n by n matrix attached to that linear transformation with a property that the action of this function on m-dimensional vectors is equivalent to multiplying column vectors of dimension m by this particular matrix. All right, and then what I'll show you then is the range of a linear transformation, the space of vectors that you can create by applying a linear transformation to one vector space and ending up in another vector space. This range of T, that you think of the shaded subspace subset of Rm, that's equivalent, in fact, identical to the column space of this matrix. Let me show you why that's true. What I'm going to do is I'm going to show this, that these two sets, the range of T and the column space of the associated matrix, the way I'll show you that those are exactly the same sets is I'll show you that every element in the range is also in the column space of the matrix, and that every element of the column space of the matrix is in the range. So this is going to be sort of like the logic here is like if x is less than or equal to y and y is less than or equal to x, then for both of these inequalities to be maintained, you need y is equal to x. Now that's true for numbers x and y, but similarly for sets, if you have if A is a subset of B and B is a subset of A, these two conditions tell you that the two sets are the same. So this is the sort of logic we'll be applying to show you that this set is equal to this set. I'll show you that every element in the range is a member of the column space, and every element of the column space is an element of the range. And then, since the sets are subsets of one another, then they'll have to equal. All right, so let's do the first thing. Let's start with, I show you that if I start with an element that lives inside the range, then necessarily it also lives inside the column space of the associated matrix. So I'll set y, I'll choose a point in the range, that means it comes from some x in the domain. And now what I'll do is I'll expand this vector with respect to the standard basis of Rm. So our linear transformation is going from Rm to Rn, and the associated matrix is going to be an n by m matrix. All right, so here I'm just restating this condition. I'm choosing a point in the range, it comes from some x. Now what I'll do is I'll expand this guy with respect to the basis, the standard basis of Rm. So I'll just expand it times the basis vectors. Now I'll use properties of T, the fact that it's a linear transformation. These vector sums can be performed after we apply the linear transformation. So that's preservation of vector addition under a linear transformation. And then the scalar multiplications inside the linear transformation, those can be delayed until after we apply the linear transformation. And now we see that any point in the image is a linear combination of these vectors, T applied to a standard basis vector for Rm. Well, those are exactly the columns of the associated matrix. But then now a point in the range is displayed as a linear combination of the columns of the matrix. Well, the set of all possible linear combinations of the column vectors of the matrix is exactly its column space. So this displays a point in the range as also being an element of the column space of the associated matrix. And we're done showing this inclusion. All right. So let's show the opposite conclusion. Now I'll choose an element that lives in the column space of my matrix, and I'll show you that it corresponds to an element that's also in the range. In fact, it's identical to it. So we'll take a vector, and it's going to live in the span of the columns of the matrix AT that we construct from our linear transformation. Well, if it lives in the span, that means it's a linear combination of these vectors. And so it expands this way. And what we'll do is remember the columns of this matrix. The way we construct this matrix is as this first column is going to be T applied to the first standard basis vector of the domain of the linear transformation T. So this column is exactly equal to that. The last column is exactly equal to T applied to the last standard basis vector. And now we're just kind of reverse the argument on the preceding slide. Because T is a linear transformation, these scalar multiplications can be taken inside the argument of the linear transformation. Well, this occurs because linear transformations are compatible with scalar multiplication. But they're also compatible with vector addition. So when I add up all these T applied to numbers times standard basis vectors, I can collapse that into a T applied to a single vector. And now it appears that W, which was chosen to be an element in the column space of A, is also in the image of T, because W occurs as T applied to some vector inside the domain. And that puts W inside the range of T. And so I've effectively done this. I've shown you that the range of T is a subspace of the column space of AT, and I've shown you that the column space of AT is a subset of the range of the corresponding linear transformation, and then these two inclusions imply that the two sets are equal. Range T is actually equal to the column space of AT. And that's great, because what does that do? It actually takes this abstractly defined set. Here's a picture of it. We go from Rm to Rm. We're just trying to get a handle on the set of vectors in the codomain that are reachable by applying this linear transformation. So it's defined by this sort of formal picture. But now what we see is, because that range defined abstractly is equal to the column space, that is very concrete. Once we compute this matrix, it's just a numerical matrix. And we know how to find bases for these, for a column space of a matrix. So that's going to give us a way of getting a calculational handle on the range of T. In fact, this identity gives us the calculational way we'll handle the range of T directly. We're going to work with this matrix A, subscript T, and its column space. All right, so that's the conclusion. And let's see. I'm not sure if I do an example yet. Well, because these are exactly the two sets, they're also exactly the two subspaces. And so what we'll do, in order to find a basis for the range of T, I just need to find a basis for the equivalent subspace, in fact, the same subspace. And so I find a basis for this. That will provide me with a basis for the range of T. All right, so I guess I do an example. All right, so here's a linear transformation that's going to take two-dimensional vectors to three-dimensional vectors. It's defined by a functional formula. A point with coordinates x1 and x2 is getting sent to a point in R3 with coordinates x1 plus x2, x1 minus x2, and x1. What we're trying to do is, well, find a basis for the range of T. So first thing we do is we compute the matrix that corresponds to that linear transformation. Now, the domain is only two-dimensional, so I'll have two columns in this associated matrix. The way I compute them is I apply T to the first standard basis vector, give me the first column. T applied to the second standard basis vector of the domain is going to give me the second column. All right, now notice, even though I've written these things horizontally, when I insert them in this matrix, I'm writing them vertically. This has three components. When I act on the first standard basis vector, that's T applied to 1, 0. Well, what's that going to be? It's going to be 1 plus 0 is 1. 1 minus 0 is 1. And simply 1, because x1 is that first coordinate. And similarly, T of E2 is going to be T applied to 0, 1. And that's going to be, let's see, it's going to be 1, minus 1, and 0. So I get these two vectors as the image of my standard basis vectors, but don't write them as rows. Convert them to columns to get the correct matrix. And so there it is. That's the matrix that we'll be working with in order to analyze this linear transformation between R2 and R3. What we need, according to the preceding slide, to get a basis for the range of T, I need to construct a basis for the column space of this matrix. Let me remind you how that's done. To find a basis for the column space, of any matrix, whether it's associated to a linear transformation or not, what we do is we row reduce A to a row or reduce row echelon form. Maybe I'll write it this way, reduce row echelon form. Or it's sufficient to go to a row echelon form, but we could go all the way to reduce row echelon form to get a unique matrix. And then we identify where the pivots live in this row echelon form. And then we grab the corresponding columns of the original matrix. Original matrix A. And those columns that we can relate to columns of the row echelon form that have pivots, those are going to be our basis vectors. So let's look at this matrix and let's row reduce it. Now it's pretty easy to row reduce this guy. Very quickly row reduces to this matrix in reduced row echelon form. And what you should see then is that both columns in the row echelon form have pivots. So I'll go back to the original matrix and I'll grab as basis vectors for the column space. What I'll use is, well, corresponding to this pivot in the row echelon form, I'll grab this first column, 1, 1, 1. And then corresponding to this second pivot, I go back and I grab the second column, 1, minus 1, 0. And so that's going to be my basis for the column space. But the column space of the matrix A subscript T is exactly the same thing as the subspace range of T. And so these guys are also going to be a basis for the range of T. However, here I've written them as column vectors. If we go back to the way I defined T, I didn't use matrices to define it. Rather, I just used ordered lists of numbers. And so what I'll do is I'll take these columns. This is still an ordered list of numbers. It's just that I've chosen to write that list vertically. I'll think of it as just a vector, not as a matrix. And so these two column vectors would correspond to 1, 1, 1. Maybe I'll even change my notation slightly using parentheses to distinguish between a list of numbers and a rectangular arrangement of numbers. But this column vector corresponds to this ordered list of numbers, and this column vector corresponds to this ordered list of numbers. And these guys are going to be a basis for the range of T. All right, so this business here where I take the column vectors and I rewrite them as ordinary vectors, I don't do that to confuse you. I'm just, I can't really decide whether I always stick with matrices to describe vectors or I bounce back and forth. Yeah.
Earlier you were saying that so this vector or matrix or this vector is an image. Would that be an image of this set B?
Yeah, so keep this picture in mind. So what the function doing is taking all the points in the domain, and generally speaking, it doesn't hit every point in the codomain. It just reaches a smaller subset. What we're trying to do is get a handle on these points that can be reached by applying the function t. So what I found is that this image set here actually corresponds to the column space of the matrix. And so the way I'm going to end up coordinatizing these guys is converting to the matrix picture, getting a basis for that column space, and then using that same basis for this. Because the range of T is identical to the column space of this matrix. So what we do, we think of this abstractly from this picture, but here's the calculational setting by how we actually compute things. Well, this is typical in this course. And in fact, I think it's really the deeper part of the course is our way of taking things that are defined some other way besides calculations. But in order to deal with them, particularly in applications, you need to take your abstract ideas and put them in a place where you can actually plug things into a calculator and develop concrete solutions to problems. And so that's the big theme of this course, is how do we take abstract things and bring it to a concrete calculational setting? That's what you're going to need to do in your applications as you leave this course. When a linear algebraic setting arises in engineering or in physics, et cetera, the main thing you want to get from this course is, well, how do we calculate that stuff? And so that's what I'm trying to describe. But the other thing that's happening here, which is just important for your applications, is I'm giving you a language for which all this translation from physical settings to the concrete calculable setting, all the language is consistent. And in fact, what you really need is the language not only to do calculations, but also to understand what's going on. If somewhat analogous doing calculus, well, you need to know what a derivative is, but in the end, you really don't have to take a derivative as long as you know how to, well, to pass the course, you only have to know how to differentiate polynomials, maybe, and that guarantees you a C in the course. Well, underlying that, though, and the reason why limits are introduced and things like that is that the idea that a fundamental physical law, such as F equals ma, can only be written down until you know what a derivative is. That's also happening in this course as well. We're developing the language for which physical laws can be expressed, or physical situations can be expressed. And then we're also not being able to sort of mimic physical situations by mathematical situations. We're also providing a calculational means to exploit that analogy. Okay, so let's see. I guess I did this. This associated matrix, it row reduces to this matrix. If I go back to the original matrix and I grab the corresponding columns, those are going to be basis vectors. And so, this column vector corresponds to this three-dimensional vector. This second column vector corresponds to a second three-dimensional vector sitting in the domain, sitting in the range of T. Okay, so that's the first subspace one it will attach to a linear transformation. There's another subspace that's very important. It's called the kernel of a linear transformation. So given a function between two vector spaces that's compatible with scalar multiplication and vector addition, I'll define a subset of the domain. So that range is a subset of the codomain. I'm now going to give attach to this thing a particular subset of the domain. And what it's going to be, it's going to be all the points in the domain that get set to the zero vector inside the codomain. All right, so the way it's set up, it's clearly a subset of Rm, because every element in the kernel starts off inside Rm, and then we put a restriction in it that so only certain vectors inside the domain are going to satisfy this condition. But it gives me a well-defined subset of the domain of my linear transformation. What I'll now show you that is that it's not only a subset, but it's actually a subspace. Yeah.
So the kernel is only numbers that are equal to zero?
It's the numbers that or the vectors. The vectors that from where you start off that end up landing on the zero vector inside after applying the function. So an m-dimensional vector under the action of t gets mapped to some n-dimensional vector, right? Well, one example of an n-dimensional vector, here, let's draw this vector space a little bit, not as a circle, but more geometrically. We got some coordinate grid, and the points, a given set of coordinates is going to land on. What we're focusing on in the kernel are the points. It's going to be a subset here, but what's required for the kernel is they all get mapped, not to arbitrary vectors over here, but they all land on the origin. What this is going to actually represent a little bit later on when we start interpreting linear transformation is that this kernel actually represents the information that's lost by applying a linear transformation. So what happens here is all these vectors here that are sitting in the kernel, they all get mapped to the zero vector, which is really the trivial vector inside the codomain. The interesting vectors inside the codomain correspond to the range, because that's where you get non-zero vectors after applying the linear transformation.
So all the images have no non-zero vectors?
No, they do. Every subspace always contains a zero vector, but the image or the range is going to contain many more vectors. On the range, we're concentrating on those vectors in the domain that sort of trivialize once we apply the thing. They get sent directly to the zero vector. So they don't give you non-zero vectors. They give you only that trivial vector that doesn't really, I mean, it never does anything, right? Once I get over here and I'm doing something with the zero vector, I scale or multiply, I get the zero vector. If I add it to another vector, it doesn't do anything. So you can think of things in the kernel as ending up here and not making any difference at all. Okay, so that's the set we're looking at. Every element in the kernel belongs to the domain, but it's also required to have the property that once I apply the function, I don't get arbitrary points over here. That could be an R. That's an Rm. But this point here, in general, it's going to live inside Rm. The codomain. But we're requiring it to equal the zero vector inside here. So it's that's the definition of the kernel. And as I've set it up, I've only specified it as a subset of the domain. What I'll now show you is that set is closed under scalar multiplication and vector addition. And so this set is actually going to be a subspace. All right. And in fact, what I'm going to show you is, in fact, this set is identical to the null space of the corresponding matrix. And then what that indirectly is showing you is that the kernel of a linear transformation is equal to this set, but this set is already known to be a subspace. When we talked about subspaces attached to a matrix, the solution set of A subscript T of X is equal to zero, that's the null space of the matrix. And that we know how to find a basis for example, by solving the corresponding linear system. So what I'm going to show you is that every element in this set can also be interpreted as an element, the null space of A, which this is defined as a set of vectors X inside Rm that satisfy a linear equation, A T of X is equal to zero. And now this, when we were talking about matrices and their associated subspaces, this is one of the three subspaces we looked at. And so what I'm showing you now is that the kernel subspace defined using function theory language is the same as the null space of the matrix, which is more using the language of solving linear systems. Okay, so let's see if I can show this really quickly. If we have a vector that starts off in the kernel, then I want to show you that, if that's true, if the x belongs to the kernel, what we're requiring is that t applied to x equals the zero vector. On the other hand, once we construct the matrix that's attached to this linear transformation, well, that matrix always has the property that t of x is equal to matrix multiplication by this particular matrix, the one we construct this way. And so if t of x is equal to zero for any point that lives inside the kernel, that's going to require, well, this is exactly equal to a t of x via this identity. And so that means that x actually satisfies a linear equation. Here's a coefficient matrix times a column vector of variables is equal to zero. So that shows you that x lives in the null space of AT, which is defined as the solution set of ATx is equal to zero. And so in fact, the kernel of a linear transformation is in fact identical to the null space of the associated matrix. Since the null space of a matrix is a subset of R, of an n by m matrix is a subspace of Rm, so too is going to be this kernel, because this null space is exactly equal to the kernel. So the two sets coincide, and we'll get a, we can simply identify these two sets. And that, in turn, is going to give us a way of computing a basis for this set of vectors that land on the zero vector after applying the linear transformation. All we have to do is calculate the matrix and figure out what its null space is. Well, that means we have to solve the linear system whose coefficient matrix is exactly this numerical matrix. So the next step, in order to solve A subscript Tx is equal to zero, we write the matrix in, we write it down, and then we row reduce this matrix to reduce row echelon form so that we can actually solve the linear system. So when that's done, this matrix row reduces to this matrix, and see here are the pivots. They're both equal to one. Above and below pivots, I have nothing but zero. That's the reduced row echelon form of that matrix. So you know, when we're solving linear systems, once we reach the matrix in reduced row echelon form, the next task is to convert back to equations. So here I did it. X1 plus 0x2 minus x3 should equal 0. And second row is going to lead you to that equation. We also use this matrix to break our variables up into fixed variables corresponding to columns with pivots and free variables that correspond to columns without pivots. We move the free variables coming from these equations to the opposite side. Then we write down a solution vector. We expand the solution vector in terms of the free parameters, and then we get a basis vector for, well, what we constructed is the basis vector for that solution set. But that it, null space of AT we've already seen to be identical to the kernel of the corresponding linear transformation. So what I've done is I've now found a basis vector, for the kernel of the linear transformation, I found a set of directions inside my domain that will reach every point that the linear transformation T sends to zero. Oops, I guess I'm running out of time. So actually, this is a good place to stop. What I'm going to do on Friday is I'm going to look again at these two subspaces, and we're going to count the number of basis vectors, and that will tell us what the dimensions are. And then we'll find that, in fact, the dimensions never disappear. It's sort of a zero-sum game. Now, the dimensions of this space get split up. Some of the dimensions are going to be carried over into the image, but they could also lose dimensions as well. And those are going to be the dimension of the subspace that gets sent to the zero vector. So the kernel, that information is lost. It's all sent to the zero vector, but the information that survives is going to be live in the range. And when you add the dimension of those two subspaces, you get exactly the dimension of the domain. Okay, so I'll stop here, and we'll pick up with this discussion on Friday.